Good morning. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current. The author of No Logo, Naomi Klein, has come out with a label for an economic program. She calls it the shock doctrine. And in her new book by the same name, she lays out her theory of how exploitative economic engineering is plaguing our world. Over the next hour, we will first discuss, then debate her theories and her global warning. The American economist Milton Friedman once said, and here's the quote, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around." End quote. It is this theory that journalist Naomi Klein explores in her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Ms. Klein argues that instability is being both fostered and used as a way to engage in policies of economic engineering around the world, whether in Pinochet's Chile in the 1970s or today in Iraq. Her book is provocative and will surely be controversial, and Naomi Klein joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, there's a phrase in your book that has stuck with me. You say instability is the new stability. You watch the stock market, you watch world politics. How do you see instability becoming the new stability?
Well, the running thesis in the 1990s was that the reason why there was so much economic growth, this is the sort of dot-com period, the new economy period, was because it was a period of relative peace and stability. And this was the Thomas Friedman thesis of, you know, no two countries with a McDonald's have ever gone to war. This idea, which of course was proven wrong a couple years later. But the idea was that if you had stable economies, then countries had a vested interest in maintaining that level of peace so that they could keep trading. What we're seeing now is that there's so much wealth being created out of moments of instability, like terrorist attacks, which spawn a whole homeland security complex, even increasingly intense natural disasters, because so much of the response to those disasters has been privatized, that the stock market now responds to disasters, like the launch of a new IPO, because they know that the disasters will unleash tens of billions of dollars in new government money that will feed the privatized reconstruction complex, the privatized homeland security complex, the war complex, that the price of oil will go up, that will make it more viable to keep developing the tar sands, and so on. So I call all of this the disaster capitalism complex. And I think that we now have an economy that is banking on instability and is treating that as the new stability.
Okay, so that's what you mean by disaster capitalism, but you talk about the shock doctrine. What is the shock doctrine?
Well, the shock doctrine is a philosophy of power. It's a philosophy of political change. And I think your listeners are familiar with the phrase economic shock therapy, which was sort of popularized more in the 90s when the economies of Eastern Europe were being very rapidly transitioned from communist systems to capitalist systems. But basically what economic shock therapy is pushing through a range of radical free market policies all at once. And in any context, it could be, you know, in Ontario, it could be in Iraq. The shock doctrine is the idea that the best way, and indeed the only way, to push through this whole economic agenda of privatization and deregulation is in the aftermath of some other shock, a body blow to a country, which could be a terrorist attack, a war, an economic meltdown like the Asian financial crisis, and that first shock sort of softens up the country for the economic shock. So the shock doctrine is that idea that you need first, that you need a primary shock to be able to do economic restructuring.
Okay, so what is it about shock that makes it such a useful tool then for furthering a political or an economic agenda?
Well, anyone who uses shock in this way is not a Democrat. You know, it's not, and I don't mean that in the U.S. presidential sense.
Small d, you're talking.
Yeah, you know, anyone who longs for crisis in order to advance their idea system essentially is looking for moments when people are disoriented, when they can't fully participate in their democratic institutions, if they have democratic institutions, when people lose their bearings. And so it's a deeply anti-democratic idea. The reason why people are drawn to shock, I think, is because they know their ideas can't be imposed in sort of non-cataclysmic circumstances. That moments when, you know, in the aftermath, say, of September 11th, or after Hurricane Katrina and the flooding of New Orleans, these are moments where we lose our bearings. The world that we thought we lived in isn't the world we find around us. We lose our script. Now, you can get oriented in that moment, but you really need a culture that is encouraging you to hold on to your narrative, to hold on to your sense of time and space. What we increasingly get is the opposite. We get leaders who encourage that feeling of disorientation, who say, you know, after September 11th, everything you thought you knew about the world is no longer applies. That's all pre-9/11 thinking. You know, we live in an entirely new world, which is about a clash of civilizations, but, you know, very actively rewrite the script and tell you
that world has changed.
And so where you've already lost your bearings because of this crisis, now you're totally unmoored.
So
and
who,
very vulnerable to their ideas.
So who tends to benefit and who tends to lose in these situations?
Well, as I said, you know, any ideological project can apply the shock doctrine. I'm looking at the application of the shock doctrine within the context of a radical capitalist program, which, because this is, we've been living through a period of triumphant free market economics for the past 35 years, this is our recent history. So who has tended to benefit have been the people who have really been the people behind this ideological movement, who are large corporations, who the project has been, it's really what I describe in the book as a counter-revolution against Keynesianism, because the period when the welfare state was being built, when the period of big government, the period of the New Deal, this was a very successful economically, a period of rapid growth, and it does work for the majority of people, but it really does eat into the ability of the people at the very top to make quite as much money as they might like. So the people who have benefited, I think we see if we look at everywhere this free market revolution and the shock doctrine has been applied, whether you know, in Thatcher's Britain or Reagan's America or you know, Yeltsin's Russia, Pinochet's Chile, you see a rapid stratification of wealth. That's the marker. So you absolutely have winners, but you have big losers.
Well, in fact, you have a statistic: 25 to 60% of the population becomes a permanent underclass.
Yeah, and we see this around the world, and that's why I think it's possible to have these coexisting narratives of the kind of world is flat narrative, where you hear just this euphoric accounting of, you know, what's happening in China, what's happening in India, this sort of booming news, at the same time as you have these jarring statistics about people who are, you know, the explosion of shanty towns worldwide, for instance. And, you know, I saw this in Argentina, where when my husband Abby Lewis and I were making the film The Take, that country experienced an economic shock. And, you know, this was a country that had the largest middle class in Latin America. And when we were living there in 2002, 2003, that was the statistic. 60% of the population had fallen below the poverty line.
You see this playing out in Iraq. What are you seeing?
Well, I went to Iraq a year into the occupation to look at really the interrelationship between two different forms of shock: the shock and awe invasion, which was, you know, it was a military strategy that self-consciously targeted the population at large. If you read the shock and awe manual that was the handbook of the invasion of Iraq, it differentiated itself from the first Gulf War because it said in the first Gulf War we targeted Saddam's military architecture. Now we're trying to overwhelm the society and induce a state of mass disorientation, that it would just be this incredible show of U.S. strength that would awe the Iraqi population into a state of submission, that they would be so aware of how overpowered they were that the idea of resistance would be futile. And in fact, that's pretty much what happened. And then Paul Bremer arrived in May. The Baghdad fell in April. He arrived in May. The city was still on fire. And within days, he was announcing that Iraq was open for business. That was his phrase.
So right away, economic changes.
It was the most radical shock therapy program that has been applied anywhere, including in Russia. And that's how Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, described what was happening in Iraq. And, you know, we have to remember this was in the context of Russia just having, its economy having imploded, and everything we know about what actually happened in Russia after that shock therapy program with the creation of the oligarchs and this huge stratification. They just repeated the formula in Iraq. In fact, went so far as to bring 40 politicians from Eastern Europe, including Yeager Geiger, who was the minister of in charge of privatization for Yeltsin, who was really blamed by Russians as being the architect of their shock therapy program. Geiger was brought to Baghdad shortly after the invasion to teach the Iraqis how they should or why they should embrace this U.S. prescribed shock therapy. And his advice was do it even faster than we did it, that you should sell the state companies before people recover. And you should cut the subsidies to oil and to food because these are the most unpopular measures. So you want to do it while people are still reeling from this other shock.
And this is some of what we've seen, of course,
exactly.
Now in Iraq. Now, there's so much to talk about with Iraq, and your views are quite complicated, and you've got a lot to say. But before we go there, let's go back a step. There are two people who stand out in your book as ideological instigators of the shock doctrine. One was the psychiatrist Ewan Cameron, who was at McGill University in the 50s and 60s. The other was the economist Milton Friedman. How are they connected?
Well, they are connected because these are two different kinds of shock doctors. I start the book with these two profiles of two different kinds of shock laboratories. The first is McGill University in the 1950s. In the 1950s, the CIA started funding researchers, in particular Ewan Cameron, who is head of psychiatry at McGill University. He caught their attention because he believed that the way to cure mental illness was to really erase the adult selves of his patients. He believed that all mental illness had been imprinted in people through their experiences. So therefore, it followed for him that what he should do was bring his patients back to a childlike state before these negative experiences happened. And so his way of doing this, and this is, he moved from the U.S. to Canada, and he was put in charge of the Allen Memorial Hospital, the psychiatric hospital associated with McGill. He believed that the way to bring his patients to this childlike state was to just blast their brains with everything he could think of. It was psychiatric shock and awe. So it was absolutely unprecedented doses of electroshock, strange cocktails of drugs. And then once he got them to this totally regressed state, where many of them forgot language, they forgot they were married, they became incontinent, they thought their doctors were their parents. Then he would start playing tape-recorded messages, telling them that you know they were a good mother, they were you know that they you know had high self-esteem, imprinting healthy personalities on this blank slate. Now, scientifically, it was a catastrophic failure.
And
we
destroyed the lives of many.
He destroyed the lives of many Canadians.
But the key to his connection is that the CIA looked at his research and used it in how they went forward with the use of torture. Am I right?
Exactly. So they funded him, and the Allen Memorial Hospital turned into a laboratory, really, for the CIA.
So what is the link between the torture of an individual through shock and sensory deprivation, as Ewan Cameron sent that whole thing rolling, and economic shock therapy?
Well, I think there's two ways in which they're connected. One is torture is a kind of a metaphor for what we're seeing with disaster capitalism. And it is also a tool to enforce, a very real tool to enforce disaster capitalism. Now, what I mean by a metaphor is that Here I'm talking about the specific methods that were developed at McGill and that were codified in the CIA interrogation manuals and then were applied around the world. And now we can see in Guantanamo sensory deprivation, the deliberate inducing of shock. You know, there's a whole ward at Guantanamo where the prisoners are just being given huge doses of antidepressants and they're absolutely regressed. They're talking baby talk. They're drawing pictures of their guards and putting it on the wall because they have been unmade as human beings. So the CIA manual talks about inducing regression and says there is a period of shock or suspended animation that may be extremely brief. And in that moment, when that moment opens up, a skilled interrogator will know how to identify it. And that is the moment when the prisoner is unable to defend their interest and is most likely to comply. And they also say that they start to see their interrogator as a father figure. I think if we look at that passage and look at that logic, that the idea of interrogation is not to beat up a prisoner, just to hurt them. It is this idea of trying to put them into a state of shock, open up a window of opportunity where they lose their sense of where they are in time and space and who they are. And then that's the moment when they comply with the interrogation. That is exactly the logic of the shock doctrine and disaster capitalism, that whether it is a shock that was created, like the invasion of Iraq, or one that simply happened, like Hurricane Katrina, that shock doctors, people who believe in the shock doctrine, understand that that is the key window of opportunity when people have lost their bearings, don't know where they are in time and space, in order to push through their economic shocks.
And the shock doctor in that economic case is Milton Friedman. Who was he?
Milton Friedman, when he died in 2006, he was described as the most influential, not just economist, but intellectual of our age. And I think there's some truth to that. He had enormous influence. He won the Nobel Prize. And he was a key figure in what is called the Chicago School of Economics, the University of Chicago Economics Department. He believed in a radical vision of capitalism in which there would be no healthcare, no public parks. He sort of very famously said, no post office. It would all be done by the private sector. And he said that the only role for government was defending the state and enforcing contracts. That, as far as Milton Friedman was concerned, that's it. That's all you need your government for. And he was really chosen as a leader for this counter-revolution and funded very generously through this think tank complex that he's been a part of. So what's interesting about Friedman is that even though he had a lot of backing from Wall Street and he was always very close, one of his closest friends was Walter Wriston, who was head of Citibank, he saw himself in the 60s and even the 70s as a very marginal figure. And he complained that they were just voices in the wilderness at the University of Chicago, because in the United States, even when Nixon was elected and Milton Friedman said, you know, he couldn't imagine a U.S. president whose ideas were closer to his own, even Nixon, once he got into power, famously declared, we're all Keynesians now, and imposed wage and price controls and won the next election. So Milton Friedman was a sort of fringe figure in the U.S., but he became extremely influential in Latin America. That was his first laboratory.
Let's talk about Latin America, because you identified Chile as having been the first full test case for the Chicago School's philosophy. How so?
Well, it comes back to the Chicago School, of course, because there was a lot of concern at the U.S. State Department in the 50s and 60s that Latin America and other parts of the developing world were moving quite far to the left, but particularly Latin America, because U.S. companies were so heavily invested, particularly in the resource sectors of Latin America. And there was a growing support for socialism and developmentalism, which is sort of the developing world's version of Keynesianism. There was famously a meeting in the mid 50s between USAID's, the State Department's Chile office, the head of State Department's Chile office, and the head of the University of Chicago Economics Department, where the head of the USAID program was saying that he was very worried about Latin America's pink economists. And they came up with this idea that they would fund a program so that hundreds of Latin American students starting with Chile, it was called the Chile Project, would come and study with Friedman and his colleagues at the University of Chicago, and they would be trained in these radical ideas, and then they would come home as sort of ideological warriors and take on the pink economists. The original vision for the Chile Project was not a violent one. It was a project of it was an attempt to change the culture of Latin America. It was an attempt to move the country to the right, but not with guns, with ideas, to have a battle of ideas. And the significance of it is that it failed miserably. You know, for what I'm trying to show with the book is that this, we hear again and again that free markets and democracy go hand in hand. Well, you know, in Latin America in this period, when the Chicago boys, the so-called Chicago boys, who had studied at University of Chicago, there were 100 of them, returned to Chile to fight it out in this battle of ideas, you know, in the free press, within the political system, they lost terribly. The Chicago boys were utterly marginal. And the ultimate proof of that was the 1970 elections in Chile where Salvador Allende was elected. But then they returned in 1973, at the same time as Pinochet's coup, the CIA-backed famous coup in 1973, the night the military was overthrowing the government, La Moneda, the presidential palace, was on fire, a group of these U.S.-trained Chicago boys were photocopying a document, a 500-page document that was known as the BRIC. And the BRIC was their prescription for how Chile would be radically changed overnight. It was the first laboratory for these policies. So if you read the BRIC, it's like reading George Bush's election platform. It's charter schools, 15% flat tax, privatizing Social Security.
It's all the things they wanted that they couldn't get in an election.
At home.
We go back to that key quote, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. So you're saying they were ready with the economic change as the coup was underway.
They were so ready that this document, the BRIC, was on the desk of every junta leader the next morning. And immediately the key Chicago boys were appointed to very influential positions within the junta government, and eventually they took up posts as finance minister, head of the central bank, all of the key economic posts, trade minister, U.S. ambassador to the U.S. I think the significance of it is that we know the history of the violence. You know, we know the history of the terror. I think we really don't know the extent to which this was an economic revolution. Latin Americans have, there's a long tradition from intellectuals in Chile, Uruguay, Argentina, talking about the interrelationship between economic shock and physical shocks. And that's why I say that torture is both metaphor in the sense that what is being done in the torture chamber in trying to put a prisoner in a state of shock and open up a window of opportunity where you can get what you want out of them, that's a metaphor for economic shock therapy. But it is also a tool of enforcement. Because often when you have these very radical programs in an environment that is hostile to them, like a continent that is moving rapidly to the left and has just elected a socialist leader, then you need some other shock to enforce it. And that shock has historically, again and again, torture has been a kind of a partner for these other forms of shock and enforcement.
Naomi Klein, I need you to hold that thought. We have to take a short break. I'm speaking with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Shock Doctrine. You're listening to The Current. Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you are listening to The Current. We are in the middle of a discussion with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. This is what makes your book so provocative. Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you are listening to The Current. We are in the middle of a discussion with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. This is what makes your book so provocative and so disturbing. The idea that you don't just parallel the idea of torture and economic change. You draw a thick line